Alrighty, so this is technically Always Record episode 21, and we will be discussing a sync between music and film that was brought to all of our attention by David Plate. Maybe we can just start this all off by explaining. Everyone knows your work with music and film, and we've discussed it quite a bit on the show. But why don't you just kind of give us a little insight as to how you were led to merging these two components?
It's strange. It's like a lot of these examples, it seems so obvious in retrospect. Like, oh, that was just waiting to happen. Why didn't I see that sooner? But this was actually... Specifically, Marilyn Manson's Hollywood with Holy Mountain, that sync led me to this. The continual references to John Lennon and trying to figure out what the connection was between John and Holy Mountain. And while watching an audio commentary of Jodorowsky with Fondo and Liz, he mentioned that John Lennon was the secret producer of Holy Mountain. So even though he's not on the credits, he actually helped produce that film. And so it gets rather complex, having to do with Sharon Tate and the Valley of the Dolls song in there. Valley of the Dolls is the Valley of the Dead. And there was a whole series of things, and they just all added up. And then it just seemed like the thing to do was to play the White Album, which was the strange justification of the Manson family for killing Roman Polanski, the director of Rosemary's Baby's wife, while she was 8.5 months pregnant. And then finding out that John Lennon actually threw a chair at Roman Polanski shortly after the death of Sharon Tate and basically expressed to Polanski that he was to blame, which seems kind of like a insensitive thing to do to somebody whose wife had just died in such like a brutal way. And the way Manson's relationship to the White Album, and then looking at, you know, obviously Marilyn Manson and how there's this idea of the Antichrist. So Marilyn Manson's Jesus Christ, or Marilyn Manson's Antichrist Superstar, goes in sync extremely well with Jesus Christ Superstar. And so that was part of this too, the idea of the Moonchild and what the Moonchild actually means. And so the Crowleyan idea that the book Rosemary's Baby was inspired by. So anyways, that's part of it. So
I do like that the White Album is 93 minutes long. So that's a nice little Crowleyan nod. Mm-hmm. Now,
can I?
Yeah, go for it.
I just wanted to ask, what do you all call this? I mean, what I've been calling it is Rosemary's White Baby Album.
I like Rosemary's Moonchild. That was kind of one idea, but I don't you know, I don't know. I haven't figured out what to do with the second part, although it seems work best, although I've tried a few different things. I like the idea. I heard somebody had mentioned Double Fantasy.
I've been doing that. I just put it up. I don't put it up anywhere. I just put it together, and I've been watching that for the last couple of days. And if you notice, the movie soundtrack starts with this ominous three notes on the piano, this ping, ping, ping. And then throughout Double Fantasy, which was the music that Lennon was working on when he died, which is, I want to jump in and say, to me, this whole, when I'm watching it, what I'm seeing is that it's Lennon's ghost story in this, you know, kind of beautiful way.
Sure. And well, Lennon signed Double Fantasy of Mark David Chapman's copy. So,
what I was saying is that he has the prayer bells that play over and over throughout that record. Mm-hmm. And that start that record, just like the film starts. And also there's just all the stuff about Yoko and having a child. And, you know, that's one of the things when we talk, I'd like to explore some of the history, because one of the things that I just realized was that Yoko had her miscarriage the day before the White Album came out. on November 21st, 1968.
That's crazy.
Is when she had her miscarriage, and then the White Album comes out the next day, and of course we're in the month of November, the end of November, so it's already Cinque, right?
Right.
And then Mia Farrow's whole like thing of like she has weird mother issues, right? Because she not only is she the child bride of Frank Sinatra, but she's also the mother of Soon-Yi Previn, who pretty much stole her boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
Woody Allen. All of it in New York, all of it in this neighborhood.
Right, and then you have, she's in Alice, right? The Woody Allen film Alice, which takes place
and
in New York as well.
Purple Rose of Cairo.
Right.
The ultimate, you know, movies are...
stepped out of the film, yeah.
Well, right. Before we get spiraling and spiraling into just endless spirals and spirals, let's try to get a little bit of structure to this. So maybe we can kind of bring the listener through the experience and not go song by song, scene by scene to make it very literal. But let's start with just something very small and easy to kind of digest is the first song with what we see in the movie. So does anyone want to grab that? Just how does, when you turn on the White Album and you turn on Rosemary's Baby, how does Back in the USSR merge into what we're seeing, and how does it begin this sort of new way of seeing an old familiar, you know, film?
Would you mind if I just play the audio that I have, because there's a way that I set it to start that incorporates those first three notes?
Yeah, go for it. That's perfect.
It's really haunting. And I'll just turn up my speakers and see if we can get it.
Okay, so I tried this many times, and what seemed to work best, it sounds like you have a very similar timing. What was the indicator for me in a similar way, like Dark Side of the Rainbow, it's like, you know, the music kicks in right when the producer shows up. In this, it's like the lyrics start, like you start singing right after it says Rosemary's Baby. So when the title of Rosemary's Baby comes up, that seems to work the best.
Yeah.
Does that resonate?
I think mine lands, I was trying to, because I read you saying that, and I couldn't quite, I think it might start, like, let's see, I'm trying to.
It's like, you started basically in the middle of the Paramount, which is like what you're right. saying, like the second ding, basically.
Yeah, on the second ding, it starts to fade in. But then, right. so now we're watching this with the Beatles singing, and all of a sudden the pink lettering looks very sort of pretty and nice. And since the music's nice, it doesn't seem ominous. And mm-hmm. it's the New York skyline, and you have this airplane coming in. So you're thinking of 9/11, you kind of have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is when, I mean, I had this moment watching this because it's floating over New York City, and it's just this kind of pretty, nice, beautiful, you know, could be a romantic comedy about New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, you know, is a romantic comedy, isn't it?
Well, sort of, although this, it's not because...
Classical definition.
Only in the sense that as the camera comes down, it focuses on the spot where John Lennon died. It goes over the rooftops, takes us through rooftops. Oh, the Beatles playing their last concert, their rooftop concert.
Right.
And folk comes right down. The producer's name is Castle, on the castle, William Castle. It comes right down, and then it settles right before we go into Dear Prudence on the spot, the very spot where John Lennon's going to die, you know, 12 years later. He doesn't even move into the building for another 5 years.
Which is nice, because obviously there's an allusion to, or a connection between the name Lennon with the USSR.
Right.
Oh, and of course, Polanski, as a survivor of World War II in Poland, was probably liberated by Russian soldiers.
He had to travel across a crazy landmass. Like he fucking as super young, like he's a child, just fucking traveling across the fucking landscape. Insane.
No, that's one of the things that's amazing to me about this film is that when you watch it now, almost everyone in it is, as great as the film is, everyone in it is more interesting for what they did around the time of this film and then beyond and before.
Right.
Like, it's just stuffed with so much history. Cassavetes, Mia Farrow, you know, Ruth Gordon, Elisha Cook Jr., Roman Polanski,
and Prudence
Frank
Farrow.
Sinatra. Huh?
Prudence Farrow, right?
Prudence Farrow, who again, now we're, so we go from back to the, from back in the USSR, and it kicks in with Dear Prudence.
In
with,
when Mia Farrow fucking enters the house.
Well, let me back up real quick. Let me back up real quick about the song Back in the USSR and how that relates to what we're about, what the world we're about to go into. There's a couple of things embedded in the song itself that branch out into the movie that I think are really, really important. Is that Back in the USSR is a tribute to a musician named Charles, and his song is Back in the USA. So there's a couple of musicians named Charles embedded in this whole sort of network that we're building here. Is one is Chuck Berry, and the other is Charlie Manson. Obviously, right. One was a lot more successful than the other, but I think Charlie Manson wouldn't have gotten into the murder business if he had been as successful as Chuck Berry. there's another thing, too, is that there was a politician in England named Harold Wilson, and he had a slogan around that time called, I'm backing Britain. And if Britain is supposed to be this new Jerusalem that everyone talks about, right? Well, what is the USSR, and why is Paul McCartney backing the USSR? I'm backing the USSR. Well, the USSR is, in the eyes of any sort of Judeo-Christian mindset, is a godless country, right? The devil in red. So is what? McCartney choosing, right? I mean, is that too big of a stretch?
I don't know. You went into a terrain that they're a godless, what does that mean?
Communism. They're atheists. Am I,
and democracy is Christian or something?
Well, I mean, you know, the whole...
They're no more atheists than Thomas Jefferson.
Well, I mean, the communism was a threat to the franchise of the churches. I mean, there's no churches in the old school USSR. That there's no room for that shit. So,
but John Lennon's sort of vision of his imagining of heaven includes no churches. And like,
they're going to back the USSR, right? I'm backing the USSR.
Right. But I would say the only thing is you lost me there on, because it's sort of repeating it's like they would call us godless Americans. It's you were repeating propaganda. They are, they're a secular state I'm back in the USSR too.
Well,
as opposed to like, just it's like calling the Yankees or the Red Sox the evil empire. It's just.
But there's something very specific here. Is that there's something very specific here? Is that the enemy or the monster in question here is Satan, and Satan is a projection of that Judeo-Christian mythos and that kind of psyche.
Okay, you know, I know why we're getting tripped up here, and this is kind of what I wanted. Actually, can I back up into some format? Because what we're going to get into here is that each of us probably, even though we've watched the same film and used the same music and are using the same history, are having very different prisms. And rather than, like, I don't want to get it, because it sounds like you're extending a very interesting metaphor that I totally want to hear and get into. But I have a feeling we should all, maybe we should each take a turn saying what it is that we see in this and what this reveals, so that we know what page we're coming from.
Well, exactly. And I agree with you. I just think that for this initiatory part of the conversation, because I think we should allow it to just flow with where the energy is really kind of, or the excitement is taking it. But if we just focus right now on the first song and the first few frames and just that draw a little cube around that first song and I'll pour in everything that we all got out of it, I think that the conversation will take it where it needs to go.
Okay.
Oh, okay, awesome. Because I just think that if you really examine what is embedded in the song back in the USSR, it starts to illuminate a lot of threads that are embedded already in the movie. And it sort of foreshadows and almost tells the entire story right there in the first song.
And what is the story that you see coming out?
Back in the mother?
Well, the Beatles are coming off the success of, you know, their last major album, Sgt. Pepper's, where they're starting
It was Magical Mystery Tour.
Well, full album proper. Album proper, because Magical Mystery Tour is a double EP that they cobbled together and sold as an album, but that's just all marketing and the record label.
Can I just throw in something here, which is really interesting when this brings up, is that, you know, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out on December 8th, which is the day that John Lennon was killed. It's also the same day that the Rolling Stones released Her Majesty's Satanic Request. Which is a response to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. But what's interesting is that that day is also a Catholic holiday known as the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, which is the day of the Virgin Mary. And so you have basically John gets shot in front of like the place. Like you have this like film about an Immaculate Conception in a sense, like it's a satirical or whatever you want to call it, like play on that idea. But then it's like, it's just so perfect. I'm just saying.
No, that interlocks pretty ridiculous, David.
Right. Okay.
And then if you think of John's whole overriding ethos is the son who never had his mother. His whole thing, the whole reason that makes him John Lennon is he's the son who never, he's imagining Julia, which is so interesting about how, where Julia plays in
which is
this.
Child of Jupiter.
Right.
Child of Jove. That's what Julia means, which is kind of far out for all of us 42 freaks.
And well, then it becomes this beat. So in that sense, so bring it back to what you're saying with back in the USSR. Where were you?
Okay, so I'm just connecting it to a political slogan that was in England of Harold Wilson's, "I'm backing Britain." And then the Beatles come out with their new album and it says, "I'm backing the USSR." It's, I mean, how against the mainstream and how rebel, I mean, it's a different kind of rebellious. It's a different kind of punk, you know? It's a different kind of fuck you to the establishment. But what does it mean? You've got this song that is a tribute to Back in the USA by Chuck Berry. It's got the background vocals that were not only an homage, but also informed by Mike Love as a tribute to the Beach Boys. And where did Charlie Manson first get connections in Southern California, but showing up at Dennis Wilson's house and hanging out for a couple of weeks and having all his family women around. And so you've got the Beach
Boys. And Mike Love went to the Maharishi
and
Mike was on the trip.
Yeah, and he's there with them. So in this song, you've got the Beach Boys. You've got, you know, a musician named Charles. You've got the Beatles taking their first real political stance by saying, we're going to back the USSR, but what is the USSR? Well, it's saying the devil isn't real. It's just a projection of unconscious desires and fears, and they're taking, you know, a graduated opinion on all this crap. And it also, which is another thing that's weird, is these people that they're bringing in, you're bringing in Harold Wilson, you're bringing in Brian Wilson, you're bringing in Charles Manson, and you're bringing in later Charles Dodgson, who is Lewis Carroll. Just as synchy-wise, you've got four people whose names end in S-O-N.
And you're forgetting Paul McCartney, of course, Aleister Crowley's son.
Yeah, well, of course.
Who wrote the tune, so it's a, you know,
right. So the amount of Aleister Crowley references is off the fucking charts.
It's off the charts.
The Roman character in the film is actually modeled to be Aleister Crowley. It's the whole deal.
Who is obviously the third person pictured on Sergeant Pepper's. But right. here's how Stuart, do you know how Stuart Sutcliffe gets worked into this? There's a song written by Hoagy Carmichael called Georgia on My Mind, which is referenced subtly by McCartney with, and Georgia's always on my mind, you know that line? Hmm? Yeah. That's a reference to Georgia on My Mind written by Hoagy Carmichael. Well, the person who wrote the lyrics for that song is a guy named Stuart who hung out with Hoagy Carmichael. And one night they stayed up till 6 a.m. writing the lyrics to this song. So this guy, Stuart, wrote the lyrics to this Georgia on My Mind. It's the only piece of music he ever published or worked on. And he went on to become a banker and never worked in music again. So it's kind of like Stuart Sutcliffe, who birthed something kind of incredible, but was never really a part of it. You know, he just was this sort of side thing. So I kind of liked
Ian Stewart of the Rolling Stones, their piano player who never appeared with them in photos, but was with the band until the 80s.
And that's why it's perfect that Elisha Cook Jr. is the one who greets them, because Elisha Cook Jr. is associated with Humphrey Bogart and Hoagy Carmichael. I don't remember which one, I don't know if it's The Big Sleep or To Have and Have Not, but Hoagy Carmichael appears in a film with Bogart. And that's the other thing. That's the whole Frank. There's the whole Frank Sinatra, Humphrey Bogart, Rat Pack, Kennedy association. That is another big historical piece of this, of the film, hovering around it. I mean, do you want to stay on back in the USSR?
Well, no. I just kind of wanted to, for some of the skeptics, I don't really know how many skeptics are listening to this, but
I'm a skeptic.
Yeah,
but for those, and I'm not saying I'm, you know, new to this or whatever. Just the depth to which, you know, when a sink like this arises, and like David says, I'm like, why didn't I ever think of this? It's so obvious. But then when you watch it,
to hide something's in plain sight too. You know that,
right? I've heard that. Someone said that once.
I don't think think it's about hiding anything. I think it's about. I think that this is just a natural way of exploring history with art that you couldn't do before you could record stuff.
Right. So there's different ways to look at this in terms of the possibility of what's actually being dealt with. The fact that if you start it anywhere, you can see that there's a feel, like it will go in line no matter what, to some degree, just like almost anything will go with anything else. But there's something that happens when it gets to a certain point where you just kind of have to like tilt your head and go, what the fuck? So I don't like a lot of the things I'll play with syncs with film. There's just a few examples where it really gets to the point where I really have to question and be like, okay, like, so Holy Wood and Holy Mountain, I consider close to flawless, right? I put that together before discovering that Marilyn Manson is very close with Jodorowsky, and they spend like quite a bit of fucking time together. And then I see Marilyn Manson's latest video, and it is the beginning of Holy Mountain. Like like the whole theme is Holy Mountain. Like that's his whole deal. Like with Holy Wood, it's a statement on Holy Mountain. So like that feels so it gets to the point where it's like, that's intentional. So then it's like, with something like this, like which he seems to be referencing in the album with like Lamb of God and all of that, like I don't know, it just feels like so like as an actual possibility that they were like, you know, basically fooling around with like, you know, like this is something that musicians do, you know, either for fun or for whatever, you know.
And I think that when you have that feeling and you know that there's a sense that these are kind of in simpatico, you know, like these two pieces of art, they're very near each other in some sort of way, that when you take the whole thing as a whole and you're left with seeing something new and something beautiful or something exciting and just entertaining, that when you start to dig into these things, the history and all the stuff surrounding it, it only reinforces it. You know, most of the time when you do some digging, all the stuff that surrounds it just makes it a stronger and more complete kind of work of art. It doesn't necessarily dissolve it or take away from it. It doesn't go, well, that's weird. It doesn't make sense. All these kind of facts from back in the USSR, stuff that I didn't know, and you do just a little bit of research, and it sort of all embeds into the experience and all the way through the song and into the film. So yeah. More than anything, I just wanted to just take that little sort of microscopic lens into it and dump all the information and just show that, you know, it made sense to me, but when I brought it into the forum here, it sort of made sense to everybody else.
Sure.
So
immediately after USSR, then you have Dear Prudence, and then, you know, what, like, I'm sitting with that, I'm like, Prudence, the tarot card, Crowley's Prudence, which is the Eight of Discs, is literally the sun in Virgo, which is the impregnated virgin, which is pretty far out.
And you have all those dudes impregnated in the first song whose last names end with sun. A bit of a stretch, not one I made in the initial viewing.
Well, you have another son, which is Jim Morrison, who's born on the day of John Lennon's death. December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, once again. And then John Lennon's birthday is that, like, which is today.
Which is today.
Is the day that Jews start the scroll of the Torah all over again. It's when they get to the bottom of that slide.
No, wait, Helter Skelter?
So, yeah, for real. So the today is the day of the year, that of the Jewish year, that basically they read the Torah throughout the whole year, right? And they start it over on today. It's just kind of a far out little fact.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Today is day one.
Yes. Yeah. And then also the fact that that is a song in the first place. I mean, the Torah was meant to be sung, and it is supposed to be the song of songs, you know, so to speak. So that's kind of far out.
And it's also interesting that the story behind Dear Prudence is that she freaked out on her transcendental meditation and wouldn't leave her little house. So John wrote Dear Prudence to get her to come out, you know, to come out to play.
Yeah, she was completely enclosed in her own world.
Right. And Mia Farrow, when it starts to play, Mia Farrow is stepping into that elevator, which ends up playing such a big role, not only in this film, but also like the elevator and the Tenant. Like, this is supposed to be part of a sort of a weird trilogy of Polanski's of Repulsion, this, and the Tenant. Mm-hmm. Which all take place in weird claustrophobic little old sort of European style apartment buildings that must remind him of places he hid out when he was a kid running across Europe, right? And through that nightmare.
And all these women, they don't work, you know? Once their husband brings them into this building, they pretty much, unless they go out to shop or he takes them out in the town, it's not like they wake up in the morning and have to go anywhere. Like, they are in their world, right? I mean, and then when they have kids, then they are more firmly stuck. And so the claustrophobia has to be, on an individual level, these women kind of entering into a prison of some sort. A very well-decorated and well-furnished, and they're very well taken care of and pampered. But anyone knows that could be completely and totally suffocating.
Okay. Mark David Chapman buys a copy of Catcher in the Rye and a postcard of The Wizard of Oz, which he uses as a bookmark for The Catcher in the Rye shortly before he kills John Lennon, right? In his psychiatric evaluation in jail after the fact, he basically expresses that he identifies completely with Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and actually had long conversations with Munchkins, which told him not to go through with the murder, which he had to basically go back and forth with in his head, talking to fucking Munchkins. Okay. Judy Garland was supposed to basically sing the song of Gotta Get Off of This Merry-Go-Round for Valley of the Dolls. She did not get that part because of a barbiturates problem, which she died from shortly before the release of the film, which is why at the beginning of the film, there is a more than usual, basically no character in this film is based on anybody in reality. You know, it's completely fictitious. Right. Like most films have, but it's emphasized like I've never seen in any other movie because they don't want people thinking that this is about Judy Garland. So that's fucking strange. And so it's interesting too, like you should appreciate this, John Phil Ryan. The Shining connects directly into all this as well, to a ridiculous degree. Once again, you have Wendy in The Shining sitting there reading Catcher in the Rye. This comes out, what, six months before the death of John Lennon or something like that. It's like, there's definitely like, there's a lot of pieces here.
And according to Wikipedia or IMDb, I think, Nicholson was actually up for the Cassavetes role, as was Robert Redford. But
right.
Polanski chose Cassavetes.
Hmm. Wow.
Now, we're going next into Glass Onion. And this is where the connection to Charles Dodson, a.k.a. Lewis Carroll, really starts to manifest itself. Because, you know, this is a movie about drugs. The White Album is clearly... dealing with drugs or the aftermath of a psychedelic revolution, a psychedelic / sexual revolution, which is essentially all the Crowleyan system boils down to, is doing it in an effective and seemingly responsible way, or at least an artful way. But Glass Onion and how it connects to Lewis Carroll is the Walrus Was Paul line.
Right, but it's also Paul maybe that's Peter in the Bible, through a glass darkly, where you get a scanner darkly.
Yeah.
So like, basically you're seeing something, but it's veiled. And so the Glass Onion, it might be actually a reference from Ram Dass, Be Here Now, where he uses the metaphor of an onion, that you're peeling away the layers of an onion. But I love how in that scene, they're at the table and there's the glass lamp that's
yes.
lit. Around, it's like totally looks like a symbolic glass onion, you know.
Well, what is the glass onion that has firmly found its way into every American living room by 1966?
It's a television.
That's right. What the fucking thing is. It's right. The thing that's it's projecting out propaganda and ways of life through three different channels in every single living room across the country. But you can be affected on how many thousands of different levels, depending upon how you enter into a program, how you exit a program, how you change the channels. I mean, this thing is like a scrying crystal ball that's just blazing like a Tesla coil, you know? It's just shooting out information into people who have no idea what they've gotten into by putting a television set into their living room. And Mia Farrow's husband is a schlock because he's trapped in the television, right? Mm-hmm. He can only get work in TV, and he's considered, you know, kind of a joke. He's a B-list actor.
It's not a mistake in Poltergeist when the spirits come through the television that it says 237. And yeah.
So, but then to jump into the whole Walrus Was Paul... Well, that's the whole Walrus and the Carpenter rap in Through the Looking Glass, all right, Through the Looking Glass, a Glass Onion.
Right.
And like you said, Mia Farrow plays Alice in this right. movie by Woody Allen in the 90s. And what is Alice a loose remake of? Anyone?
Anyone?
Bueller? Anyone? Anyone?
Go, drop it.
Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits.
Oh, Juliet, yeah, that's right.
Really?
And Juliet of the Spirits came out in 65, and it's this sort of, from what I gather, in Alice, Mia Farrow takes herbs and potions, but ultimately she realizes that her true calling is in Calcutta, which is in India, and she's going to work with Mother Teresa. So in Alice, in Woody Allen's version, she goes into this apartment, she takes a bunch of drugs, but then she saves herself by going to India. So that's the Beatles story. In Fellini's story, Juliet of the Spirits, she essentially, it's basically the same thing. She's not as beautiful and hip as everyone around her, so she takes strange drugs and has strange sex, and then realizes she's better off without it, or something like that.
It was actually his wife who played the character of Juliet in Juliet of the Spirits, which is another Woody Allen, Mia Farrow, Sharon Tate, Roman Polanski,
right?
And what
Yoko
it,
and John
and Fellini is literally a Roman. He's right. From Italy, and his father moved to Rome in 1915, where he met his wife, who was a Roman Catholic.
Huh. I like how Mia Farrow is the last unicorn, where there's a number of characters that are named after children of Jupiter, actually. But that Rosemary, etymologically, the name Rosemary actually means dew of the sea, is how it translates. And so if you watch The Last Unicorn, all the unicorns are held in the sea as the dew of the sea. Like, I don't know the last time you guys have seen The Last Unicorn, but it's like, it's crazy. The whole ending sequence with the red bull that's like basically keeping them there locked in the sea like that. But it's like, I don't know. It seems pretty direct.
Yeah. I mean, you have.
That reminds of The Shining with the, you know, Jack the Bull keeping, keeping his family inside a, if not, you know, like water as snow in place of water, trapping them in.
Mm-hmm. It's also got a Minotaur quality of like in the labyrinth, which is really appropriate when you think of like Dan's labyrinth, you know.
Also, like Cassavetes' eyebrows are kind of come into play. Mm-hmm. As with the Roman Cassavetes character, too, also has like the hooked eyebrows that Nicholson enjoys millions from.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you have this movie in 65, Juliet of the Spirits. You have Mia Farrow being identified through the White Album as Julia, which is John's dead mother. You have her identified as Alice through the Looking Glass. And then you have her later on in Woody Allen's movie Alice with a lot happier ending than Rosemary's Baby. It's just really odd how that all mixes together.
And why don't you also make her Yoko, because she's living in Yoko's apartment, you know, and she's scaring. I mean, the birth stuff, like all this birth stuff, if you see it and if you look at it as this is John and Yoko, this is like when I watch it, I can't help but see it as sort of like John's dead dream of his life using. I guess my imagination and the elements at hand, but this is, and we're hanging out in John and Yoko's place for this whole movie.
Yeah, totally. And when they get it on and like it's like life goes on, that's so like it's so ridiculous and yet it makes so much sense, like as soon as it goes in that direction. That's really
and
weird.
The way that they spell obladi oblada, if you rearrange those like Scrabble tiles like she does in later in the movie, you have Diablo and Diabla. You have devil and like she devil. I don't know.
Yeah, I can dig that. That's weird.
Diablo, Diabla.
They're starting a family, right? A couple of years, we have built, you know, a sweet little coven or something like that.
Yeah, it's the whole deal. And then he was married in the first place. And then his child, who he didn't hardly pay any attention to from his first wife, now here his next child, he's just like being the like classic like father, what a father's supposed to be for him. Meanwhile, his other son has to like watch that. It's like the weirdest fucking thing, you know.
And speaking of aggressive
his
piano.
His other son is the one that he gave away.
Right.
And speaking of aggressive piano openings, like those very aggressive and sharp piano strikes at the beginning of the film, apparently the story of the recording of Obladi Oblada was that Lennon came in and heard Paul playing it and said, "This is just more of Paul's granny music shit." And he left the studio, only to come back several hours later, stoned. he walks up to the piano and starts playing the opening melody just very hard and very aggressive and just sort of, you know, like an asshole joining in to Paul's little piece of music. And it worked, so they kept it. So that's why the beginning of that song has that very sharp attack on the piano keys, because Lennon was just doing some of his probably classic passive-aggressive bullshit in the studio. So I like the way that that links to the beginning.
I think it's worth mentioning the Passover plot, which was one of John Lennon's favorite books, which is why he was attacked on this Christianity issue, when he said that, you know, Christianity will go and rock and roll will basically go on or take its place or whatever. You know, this book, The Passover Plot, you know, if whoever is the walrus, the other person has to be the carpenter, which means whoever is the walrus is the trickster. And, well, the other one is a trickster, too, in terms of the Passover plot. But whoever is the walrus, the other one becomes Jesus, which is kind of far out, as they fight over who the walrus is, back and forth between Paul and John. Meanwhile, I just want to mention, if you look above the baby at the end, here you have a upside-down cross, which is actually the symbol for Paul in the Bible. Paul isn't in the Bible itself. It doesn't have that, but it's a Catholic idea that Paul was crucified upside down. And that is actually the origin of the upside down cross. It is not like a Satanist symbol.
The hanged man.
And which brings us right into Heath Ledger and the Killing Joke and everything else for days.
And Danny writes murder on a upside down cross embedded in the door in The Shining.
That's right. Absolutely. Totally. And then you have Apollo, which is, I mean, Nietzsche has it in The Birth of Tragedy that Apollo literally translates as the shining one. It literally means the shining one is the translation of is one translation of it. The other one is destroyer, which, it, you know, depending on who you talk to, although both are equally true in their own way etymologically. So anyways.
And for any Lost fans out there, no, I'm not going to even go down that road.
So, Blackbird singing in the dead of night?
Wait, go on.
Crowley?
Yeah.
Crowley? Anybody? Blackbird? Crowley? I don't know.
Oh, that's... That's bad. Did you have you tracked all the putting on of records? Like, I think it's interesting. In the movie, she puts on a record.
Oh, once. Right.
She actually puts on a record twice. One of them, she's playing Piggies.
Uh huh.
Which I think is just weird. Like, she's sitting there on, you know, Polanski's filming this blonde woman sitting on her couch reading Yes, I Can. With Piggies playing, and somewhere else, Manson's listening to the same song and thinking something very different.
And political Piggies.
Right. And then the woman whose face is kind of Piggy comes in at that point. But then there's another time when she puts on the record, and it's maybe it's at the party, in the party sequence. And then during Revolution Number 9, which is at the end of the party, Cassavetes steps on an LP in the middle of Revolution Number 9. Mm-hmm. And I just, the tracking where, like, the media show, where they're, well, that's where the Beatles show up in this, like, it's their cameos. Oh, except that also tracking the dates, like, what happened in Beatles history and the dates that this film is supposed to happen. This is very interesting. Mm-hmm. The baby's supposed to be born on June 26th, 1966. On June 26th, 1966, Paperback Writer was replaced as the number one song in the country by Frank Sinatra's Strangers in the Night.
Ooh,
that's creepy. And Strangers in the Basement.
Fucking dancing to Strangers in the Night in the fucking crazy-ass underground party.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just saying.
and in Beatles history, that day, June 26, 1966, the Beatles had a 9-hour layover in Anchorage on their way to Tokyo. And on just poking around on that trip, they're stuck on the tarmac or stuck in Anchorage for 9 hours in the land of the midnight sun. And Ringo Starr has one of the first ever personal cassette recorders. And he's walking around recording people for the first time, like monkeys with, you know, fire, you know, setting up the stuff so that we can now like have these documents. Like, it's the beginning of having so much information, and the Beatles are all at the center of this. And that's what was going on in the day that little Andy or Jenny was supposed to be born.
Right.
The names of her baby, which freaks me out, because I was born right in this time. And Andy or Jenny is, well, my name's Andras and my last name's Jones. So AJ, the fact that it's very hard to watch this and also not think that it's about that I'm the devil baby.
Totally. And so I'm born on December 8th, which is the day that John Lennon was killed, a year to the day afterwards. So when I know it's your, it's your birthday comes on, fucking song comes on the moment. So if you got the timing right, you'll see this. The moment it comes out from fading to black after she gets impregnated, when she wakes up in the morning, that's when, you know, it's your birthday comes on. And so, my girlfriend warns me about personalizing too much, because she can see I'm getting excited about this, but, you know, over all these little things. And I'm like, oh, but it's my fucking birthday. And so that's weird.
Well, no, but I think that sequence is like, you know, in any great sync film, as I'm starting to figure out, there's like two or three moments that are 10 minute stretches or something that you could show to someone and just say, just watch this. It's, you know, it'll blow your mind. And that sequence from Why Don't We Do It in the Road to Julia to Birthday, which is basically the rape of Rosemary.
Okay.
Is such an intense, there's also a scene in, I'm watching it right now. There's a scene in Bungalow Bill where Cassavetes is looking at a piece, is holding a newspaper, and on it there's an ad sort of with three guys with guitars and long hair, sort of Beatles-y kind of advertising. I was on one sync tread and got caught up in the one, because I'm sort of watching this while we're going through it. So we went from Obla-Dee to Obla-Da, we're Bungalow Bill, and we're coming up on what is, I think, the most intense sync.
Your guitar gently weeps.
Yeah. You want to talk about that? Because
it's perfect. Yeah.
It's
like
perfect.
There she is fucking dead in front of the Dakota. Like, and what, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? And then they show you. Like, and she's talking to the girl in the laundromat right before that, who basically, she has the devil's pepper around her neck. Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what she carries around her neck, which she eventually throws into the drain. But it's the whole, like, you can just see how, who she's relating to. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
If she had had headphones on at that time, she would have had Sergeant Pepper's on headphones around her neck.
Right. But to me, the whole aspect of that, this is a reenactment before the fact of John Lennon's murder. It's on the same spot. And when you walk, like when they're walking up, it just looks like New York night. It does not look like the way it's shot. It doesn't look like New York night 1968. It could be New York night tonight. I've been on that corner,
right?
You know, there's a way, because the way that you don't see any cars in the shot, you just see, I don't know. It's so creepy to me, that aspect of it. But of course, that's, I don't know.
From a sync technical standpoint, that scene registers a direct hit on the level in which it was created as well, because Harrison, apparently in composing that song, he was inspired by the I Ching, which is obviously the Book of Changes. So he opened a book at random to find inspiration to write a song. And he did this while he was at his mother's house. And so the first two words he saw on the page were gently weeps. So based on just pure randomness, this song was born. I don't know if the song would have had different words or different music had he found a different passage. Or mm-hmm. I mean, was that song in George Harrison only to be revealed by coincidence and chance? Or would he have stumbled upon it, you know, on some other day in some other room on some other strain of sweet-ass weed that he was smoking? But, you know, that's amazing. I mean, if that's true, I'm only going by, you know, internet sources. I'm not going by talking to Harrison himself. But, I mean, as a false story, well, then, you know, that's pretty good, you know, stoner lore. But if it's true, I mean, my God, it's a nice little warning for all the heads out there if you get involved with some of this shit, because that... that pairing of that song and where the movie had taken us until it got into that song. I mean, it's just gorgeous. It's like it was made for it, you know? That's the point for me when I kind of forget that I'm watching two separate things, you know, mm-hmm. that they completely have merged into one stream. And Andres, I like what you say about how you recognize a really good sync film is that you have islands of continuous cooperation that lasts for over 5 minutes, and they carry the experience because they hit so hard, and then they kind of disentangle each other, and there can be a little bit of a lull, and the mind can say, "Well, I doubt that it's gonna, you know, come back again," and then in a good one, it does.
Yeah,
and then it falls apart, and then it comes back again. There's this whole death rebirth, you know, this sort of death resurrection with the themes in these things that you're combining that really, really heighten the experience. And I would have to say that with the Wild Honey Pie and Bungalow Bill, I was starting to lose trust in the value of this. But with When My Guitar Gently Weeps, it was kind of like the perfect end to the side of an album, you know? Like, that was side one, and it was an amazing side. And if the other three sides of the album are going to be good, if they're as good as this, then, you know, I'm glad I paid the price for the ticket. You know, I'm in for the long run. And before I jump off this point, no, go for it, Andres.
I was going to say, it's like listening, well, just like listening to a record. You know, if it's really good, the first time you listen to it, you know it's good. But it makes you just want to listen to it again. And then the next time, knowing the record, you hear more. And I think that's what it is like, I probably have seen Rosemary's Baby twice before this. But in the last 2 weeks, I've probably watched it 25 times. You know, and it reveals, and with the music, because I can listen to the White Album forever.
It's amazing to say that number out loud sometimes, isn't it?
What, 25 times?
Well, in the span of 2 weeks to watch a movie 25 times. It's funny when you actually say shit like that out loud, right?
Well, yeah. No, I guess, yeah. I mean, it is because it's not like watching a movie. It's like...
Well, like if
the movie becomes a part, is the visual expression of the music.
Well, you're interacting with it too. I mean, you feel the sense that you're a part of it because you're playing with it. It's malleable.
With this, the history, I mean, it's not like I didn't kill John, like I didn't make that up. You know, I didn't make up all of these things are real history that have. You know, it's just, you know, it's time travel.
I agree with that.
This feels like time travel.
Well,
like,
I think that's one of the main values of sync is that you're basically looking, like, especially when it comes, isn't it weird how we find more synchronicity in relationship to tragedy than, like, anything else, almost inevitably? And I wonder if, like, it's part of our desire to recognize how malleable our relationship is to tragedy, which when you look at, like, Greek tragedy, the way that the Greeks related to tragedy, that was the whole point. Like, they're communicating with a satyr chorus who's relaying the undercurrent of an actual scene. They would actually drown out the actors and the play with music, and the people would relate to the music and then see the play. Everyone's familiar with the play, which is a tragedy. Right. But then they're interacting with the Seder chorus, and the Seder chorus is basically playing the same role as the Beatles are playing here, or like the Doors play with my Shining experiment.
Well,
so
that says it all right there, right? I mean, that's it.
Yeah, I think that that's the point. Is it's a reconciliation on one level, but it's a recognizing that if you change your relationship to something that's extremely, the tragedy is symbolic, right? And so when you change your relationship to the symbolism, it gets reflected in your own life. So that basically, like, it has a liberating effect, which is like the whole point. Like, you have a horror movie. And you're, which is supposed to be a tragedy, and you're relating to it in a different way, and you're exploring new avenues of thought. Just, it's a very valuable thing.
But what I think is so amazing is that it reveals a much more devastating horror movie.
For sure.
Lurking, like, wouldn't you like to be in this movie? I mean, you got to be in a movie with Roman Polanski and all like that. But no, like, this was, you know.
Yeah,
and just
evil is basically hanging around a bunch of old nerds.
I don't even know if it's like it's just
like the evil characters are so banal, yeah, and boring. It's like very very analogous to what would actually happen if you ended up in a coven of witches. You'd just be bored to death.
It's an interesting take.
You know, a party with like too much dessert or whatever.
Well, look, do you look at the way that Minnie eats her dessert? Like, when she has a piece of cake, that broad is attacking the shit out of that cake. Because what's in that cake? It's not just regular cake. That's some space cake, you know? Minnie has been in that apartment for 3 decades, listening to the same old bullshit. And, you know, it's nice. Some young people. So they got some life, you know. Maybe they come over, they have some cake. I get high, you know. Life is good.
Have a vodka blush.
Yeah, try something different. What are the kids into? You know, the whole movie is through the Catholic lens of Rosemary, and I mean, as a Catholic, as a Midwestern Catholic, and as an Irish Catholic, you know, I relate to it completely. I have a tidbit in my Sync Book 2 piece relating a story of how when I went to college and I first saw a copy of The Book of Lies by Crowley. And I really knew very, very little about who or what Aleister Crowley was, except for his relationship to the Ministry album that was out at that time, Psalm 69. And so associating the kind of debauchery and insanity that Ministry was around 1994-95, and trying to see this book that was published in 1913, you know, I really had a sort of Stephen Mercado idea of Aleister Crowley. And when I opened up the book to a random page, I thought that the chapter headings were written in a satanic language, kind of like a Necronomicon. Now, I consider myself pretty well educated, had a good education. I couldn't recognize that that was Greek, you know? Mm-hmm. That Greek writing, to my mind, in that set and setting, with what my brain knew of the author, all I saw in front of my eyes for a good couple weeks was satanic letters, and probably I shouldn't look at it because it's going to embed itself into my mind. That's pretty whacked out. You know, I mean, it's really whacked out.
You have like a certain level with him where he's pushing the appearance. If you have a fear of something, you know, he'll play on it and he'll trigger it until you look at it. You know, he's like almost beckoning you to pierce the glass onion, you know?
Yeah. But this is so. Just a straight up alphabet that my mind's eye strangled into demonic lettering out of the Book of the Dead or the Necronomicon. And I just think that that's kind of insane. But I can't imagine what, you know, a young Catholic Midwestern person would have thought of Rosemary's Baby, to see that movie and not be able to see it again for many, many years, you know?
My mom read it when she was a little girl. not little, but when my mom was like teenager, she's like 15 or 16 or something, she read it and loved it. It was like her favorite book, that and The Exorcist. But
what's terrifying to me is that my mom, if she didn't see it while I was in utero, at least she knew about it. Like, this film was out terrifying my particularly pregnant mother. For the devil baby inside her.
Yeah, my wife was really into it, and she was pregnant too.
The in description of the child in the crib, that was my mom's main complaint with the film, was that they never show it. And I think it's actually one of the values of the film, is that they leave it to you. Like, there's something more scary about what you don't see than what you do.
Absolutely.
But there was a full description. It had like basically like flipper arms and was just totally deformed and crazy looking, you know, but whatever.
So what, there was thalidomide in that pudding?
That's Mia Farrow's a great actress. She sold that. I mean, the look on her face is enough.
Yeah.
When she recoils in horror the first time. And then it sets up the look of love the last time to make it that even scarier. Oh, no, the end of the movie's brilliant. It's Johnny's birthday. It's Johnny's birthday. And we would like to wish him all the very best. It's Johnny's birthday. It's Johnny's birthday. And it's so nice to have you back, so be our guest. Wish yourself.